Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Midwest Madness, your true crime cult conspiracy and crypto podcast. I'm Emily.
And I'm Danielle.
Happy Tuesday.
Yes. Happy everybody. Birthday tomorrow. Oh, yeah.
Tomorrow. I'm having some mixed emotions about it.
I was going to ask how you were feeling about it because this one was hard for me.
Yeah. I'm turning 30.
Which is
feels weird to say.
I know.
I feel pretty good about it. I've had a very good year.
Yeah, I would agree.
And
made some big life decisions this year and
yeah,
really like started to take care of yourself
on me yeah. a lot more.
Yeah.
And I know people say that all the time, like, oh, you know, I'm going to focus. I'm focusing on myself, but I really feel like I have.
I would agree.
Like done a lot of good me work this year. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, 30s I feel like always a big one. I think my biggest thing is I always feel like I'm a little behind.
Oh yeah.
And I know you can understand that too, totally. Especially when all your friends are already on like second kids and marriages and have like long-term boyfriends or whatever.
Yeah.
But I also like love my life.
Yeah.
So I'm okay. You know, I fluctuate between.
Yeah, I get that. I totally get that.
So, I mean, I'm ready to turn 30. It's a big milestone. I'm the first one in all my friends, of all my friend groups, to turn 30. So,
I didn't know that. I thought one of your August birthdays was the year before.
No.
That court was.
They're both closer to Allie's age almost than they are mine, actually.
Okay.
They are closer to Allie's age than they are mine.
So, they were young for your grade.
Yeah.
Okay. See, and I thought Court was
old.
Opposite, and Britt was young.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Courtney's the youngest.
I thought they were like a year apart.
Mm-mm. Nope.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah. So it'll be good.
Yeah. It's going to be nice. And your party is going to be
having
fun.
A birthday party. So.
So it'll be an interesting time.
Yep.
That's for sure.
Yep. It will be. And yeah. So big birthday tomorrow. I have the day off.
Oh, yeah, because your work is cool and does that.
Yeah. It's fun, but it's hard at the same time because no one else gets your birthday off.
Right. And it's a Wednesday this year. It's a Wednesday. So it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
If it was a Friday, it'd be nice. Like, my birthday was a Friday this year. It would have been great to have that off, but.
Yeah.
Nah. I could have, but I didn't.
I'm going to get my hair done. That's my plan.
I love that idea.
So, yeah. All right. Mine is kind of long this week, so
we're back to our regularly scheduled episodes because I had two in a row and then now you had two in a row.
Oh, so yeah, I forgot we did. No, because my last one was a regular one.
No.
Oh, I get
what
you're
saying. I mean is like our schedule's back. Yeah. Because I did that haunted thing, so we wanted to cover that before it was like the middle of November.
Right, I forgot about that. So, yeah, back to our normal schedule now.
Yes.
I'm in Nebraska.
Okay.
Again. My second favorite Midwestern state, as I like to call it. To tell the story of Helen Wilson and the Beatrice Six.
Doesn't sound familiar.
Okay, I hadn't heard this story either. And after I got through it, I was like, how have I never heard this?
Okay.
Because there's some, like, relevant stuff that happened in, like, not that long ago.
Okay.
And I just feel like it's right up our alley. So, and I lived in Nebraska and I didn't hear about it. Yeah. So. Okay. I don't know if I need to move my car. I should
be far enough over. Sorry.
All right. Beatrice, Nebraska is about 40 miles south of Lincoln and about 20 miles north of the Kansas border in central Nebraska. Beatrice is a smaller, quiet community that has a population of just about 12,000 people. It is known for being safe. So it's not like super small, but it's rural Nebraska. Yeah. Okay. So
it probably feels smaller than it actually is.
I think it feels bigger than it actually is.
Okay.
Because it's in rural Nebraska.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Is known for being safe and a great place to raise a family. Helen Wilson was raised in Beatrice before she, too, decided to raise her children there. She had two sons and one daughter, and at the time of her death, was also a grandmother to 7 grandchildren and a great-grandmother to 5 great-grandchildren.
Jeez.
She was only 68.
Jeez.
I know. She loved to play bingo a few times a week and volunteered at the nursery at the Methodist church that was located just a half block from her apartment. Our story starts back on Tuesday, February 5th, 1985, when 68-year-old Beatrice had come down with a chest cold. Her son, Daryl Wilson, made his daily visit to his mom's house for coffee that evening, and his wife, Katie, joined him there after she went to her weekly bowling game. This had become the couple's, like, weekly tradition.
That's adorable.
And it was something that they never missed. So they would go, and they were the type of people, they said that they could drink coffee at any time of day and it didn't bother them.
Nice.
So.
You're like, can't relate.
But that night Helen really wasn't feeling well, so she sent her son and daughter-in-law away early and decided she wanted to go get to sleep. Shortly before midnight, Katie called Helen's house to remind her to take some medicine. However, Helen did not answer the phone. Apparently, she had a medication that had to be taken at midnight every night, so okay. People would, like, sometimes call her and remind her to take it.
Okay.
The next morning, one of my articles said Helen's sister found her, but I watched a documentary, and that said her son, one of her sons found her.
Okay.
So I'm not 100% sure on...
So someone in her family.
Her family found her.
Okay.
Dead on the floor of her first floor apartment, with an Afghan tied so tightly around her face that it distorted her nose.
Oh my God.
Her hands had been bound, and she was still wearing the blue nightgown she had put on the night before. A perpetrator's type B blood was found on her mattress, on a wall, and in her underwear, and she had been sexually assaulted and suffocated.
Mm.
At first, police thought... There was semen found as well, I should say. At first, police thought the person who committed this crime could have been someone in a, quote, religious fever, end quote, because there were several churches nearby. They also speculated... I just want to remind everyone, this is 1985, okay?
Okay.
I'm prefacing this whole story with that. They also speculated that it could be possibly someone who wasn't straight because Helen had been sexually assaulted anally. So...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Officers planted a voice-activated recorder in a flower pot at Helen's grave to see if they could hear anything suspicious. And they also asked the owner of an adult bookstore in Beatrice for a list of known homosexuals. Yeah.
And that made my face go, ooh.
Yeah. Like, how would they know? You know?
Whatever. Yeah. Just because you read something doesn't make you that something.
Oh, exactly. Right?
So...
And FBI...
Because Emily reads mafia stories doesn't mean she's in the mafia.
Right. And I don't want to be.
You looked a little bit scared when I started that sentence.
What is she going to say? An FBI psychological profile described the suspect as a, quote, loner who had psychological counseling and collected pornography and who was odd and wimpy, end quote. Wouldn't you be so pissed if that's how
that was your description?
Odd and wimpy. That's funny. Okay. It was also theorized that Helen's murder could be connected to a series of 1983 attacks against elderly women in the area, but none of those attacks ended in murder and no arrests have ever been made in those cases.
Yikes.
Police interviewed over 100 people, but weren't getting anywhere. The investigation ultimately went cold. Now, a young hog farmer at the time named Burdette Searcy, he goes by Bert.
Okay.
Who was a former officer with the Beatrice Police Department, told Helen's daughter that he would try to solve the murder. He was going to do it, kind of take on the case pro bono, like side work, PI kind of situation. He said he was unfulfilled by his work as a farmer and began working the case as an unpaid private investigator.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
2 years after the crime, Searcy gave up farming and was hired as a deputy in the Gage County Sheriff's Office, where he stayed on the Helen Wilson case, even though Beatrice Police Department was the one in charge. He brought up talked about the Helen Wilson case so much that the sheriff eventually told him that he was, quote, damn tired of hearing about it, end quote, and told him, quote, if you think you can solve it, then get it done, end quote. In March of 1989, Searcy drafted up an arrest warrant for a woman named Ada Joanne Taylor and her friend Joseph White, based off information he had collected as a private investigator. He had also heard from a 17-year-old informant that they had heard about Joanna. Ada Taylor goes by Joanne. So I'm going to be calling her Joanne for the rest of this, just so everyone knows. So she claimed to have heard Joanne brag about committing the murder. She apparently told Bert that on the morning of that Helen's body was discovered, they were walking to school. It was 7:30 in the morning, and they saw the police cars outside, and Joanne looked at her and was like, yeah, you know, an old woman was murdered there. She was suffocated. There was a struggle. There was a kicked over footstool by her. And
so basically she just knew things she definitely shouldn't have known.
Yeah, and all the stuff matched.
Okay.
What she told him.
Yikes.
According to Cersei's notes, Joseph was, quote, a homosexual and a very strange young man, end quote, and that Joanne, in the days after the crime, was reported by friends to have been, quote, very nervous. Joseph White had actually been originally interviewed in those 100 people I talked about earlier.
Okay.
But he had been ruled out at the time because he didn't have type B blood. Okay. I guess they had collected DNA from a bunch of these people.
Okay.
These men, specifically, that they had talked to earlier and tested a bunch of DNA previously. Or I shouldn't say DNA because DNA testing wasn't around, but blood testing. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Cersei and another deputy took a sheriff's plane to Alabama to interrogate and arrest Joseph White. He had since moved back to his hometown, and most of the questions they asked him were about his sexuality. Joseph denied being involved, saying it was, quote, pure deep bullshit, end quote. The next day, they flew to North Carolina, where Joanne Taylor had also moved back to her hometown. Cersei spoke to Joanne, and I keep calling her Joanne. It's Joanne, sorry.
Okay.
And Joseph for a few hours, telling them all about the crime, but didn't start recording anything until they were ready to confess. The video of Joanne's confession starts with her laughing at something the cops have said. At this point, she had already confessed to the crime, saying Joseph had pressured her into it. However, during the taped confession, Joanne has a hard time remembering a lot of the details and asks for help recalling them.
So, we're not buying it.
Cersei suggests that maybe she's blocking things out because she just doesn't want to remember.
Yeah, okay.
Which she agrees she has done before with things from her childhood. Both Joanne and Joseph were brought back to Beatrice. When Joanne had been in Beatrice previously, she had been recommended by Child Protective Services to see a psychologist named Wayne Price, who was charged with helping her become a better parent. When she came back to Beatrice after she'd been arrested, she requested to see him again because she trusted him.
Okay.
And she just wanted to talk everything out. He told her that if she relaxed, the memory would be more likely to occur. So he's saying, if you just relax, the memory of this murder will come back to you. Because at this point, she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I wasn't there. Right. And they're telling her that, yo, you just don't remember. You were there. You just don't remember being there.
I hate this.
He told her that maybe she would start remembering in her dreams. Or it may occur in bits and pieces. Joanne told a second psychologist who evaluated her that, quote, in my head and in my heart, I know I wasn't there, end quote. But after she had undergone several interviews, she began to give up her idea that she was, in fact, innocent. Cersei had outlined her role in the crime and told her, quote, kind of let that build and think about it if you can, end quote.
Isn't that just the craziest fucking thing that you can know for a fact? That you didn't do something, and after, you said a few hours, right? Or was this a few interviews?
So after several interviews.
Yeah. You can be completely like, maybe I did.
Just wait, Danielle.
Oh, is it going to get so much worse? Oh,
do you not remember me saying it's the Beatrice 6?
Oh my God, it didn't even click. Oh, fuck.
So Joanne eventually began to build a narrative. She said, quote, I can put myself in her place because I have been through sexual abuse and that's what makes it rough on me, end quote. When she would recount Helen's rape, she would always cry. At first, she had told Searcy that the rape had occurred in a white single-story house with a porch, much like the house that she had lived in as a young child. But we know that Helen lived in an apartment. But she said, quote, "Everybody kept telling me that it was an apartment. Then it dawned on me that it wasn't a house," end quote. She also said told Searcy during the rape, she could hear herself screaming, "Stop, don't, it hurts, leave her be." She said she then heard Joseph say, quote, "Joanne, you know you deserve it," end quote. But she told him that it sounded like her stepfather's voice and not Joseph's. After seeing photos of the crime scene, Joanne changed her narrative and said that she had been Helen's protector. She said she had picked up a pillow from the couch and held it over Helen's face as an act of compassion. She didn't want Helen to have to see Joseph's face after the rape was taking place. She didn't realize that she was pushing too hard and that she was killing her. Now, we know that Helen was suffocated, but it was with an Afghan wrapped around. It wasn't with a pillow.
Yeah.
One cop with the Beatrice Police Department named Ralph Stevens thought that Joanne was delusional, and when he mentioned his opinion to the sheriff, he was told that he was, quote, muddying the waters, end quote. The police department was removed from the investigation shortly afterwards. The chief of police thought they had the wrong people, but again, this case was now with the Gage County Sheriff's Department, so...
Oh my God.
During one of Joanne's early interviews, she casually referred to another boy who had been in Helen's apartment that night, but her description of him was vague and would dissolve into nothing, essentially. Because I'm sure this might come as a shock to you, but she was also not type B blood.
Okay.
She would describe him as, quote, "not real slender, not real bulky," end quote, or, quote, "not black hair, but not quite real blonde," end quote. She was shown a lineup, but Searcy of six photographs with guidance. She picked out a high school classmate, Tom Winslow, who Searcy thought was bisexual. Tom, at one point, had also seen Price, which was the psychologist.
Okay.
There's a lot of, like, characters in this, so if you need me to, like, reference back on who people are, I can. He had diagnosed him with depression, writing down that he, quote, "does seem to obsess about not hurting others. He focuses on the discomfort of others and tries to make everyone feel better," end quote. By the time that Searcy began his interview of Tom, he had already accepted blame. Tom had. He said he was pressured to accompany the two others to Helen's apartment and then fled when he heard Helen scream. When Searcy had Tom's blood tested, he found that he also, like Joanne and Joseph, was not type B blood. So this obviously meant to Searcy that there were others involved.
I just don't understand, like, how you can be so one-track mind about something like that. Like, how is Searcy so, like,
get into it at the end. Deborah Sheldon was Helen's grandniece and was friends with the same crowd that Joanne and Tom and Joseph kind of belonged in. None of them were really friends, but they were all, like, acquaintances.
Okay.
Deborah's name was on a list of possible suspects because of her friendship with Joanne and Joseph, but Deborah wasn't very bright and had a lower IQ, so she is essentially, like, what's the right way to say it? Mentally, I guess, a little bit mentally slower. Is that a okay way to say it?
I would just say that, like, she would have qualified for special education.
Yes, that's okay. That's a good way to say it. A psychologist wrote that, quote, "she is essentially incapable of defending an independent opinion." So when she came in for her first interview, she seemed more concerned with masking her intellectual disability than implicating herself. So she answered her questions with vague phrases, avoiding any verbal risk. She told Searcy that she had helped the other three gain access to the apartment because the family of Helen Wilson was adamant that she wouldn't have opened the door for someone she didn't know. And the door wasn't forced open or anything like that.
Okay.
So she was the one that helped the other three gain access to the apartment, but when she saw what was happening, she tried to intervene, and Joseph pushed her away. But I'm sure you can guess, Deborah's blood type wasn't type B either.
Shocking.
So Cersei pressed her on whether or not a fifth person was in the apartment. Her court-appointed lawyer, a man named Paul Kersland, wanted her to meet with Price, who was the psychologist.
Yes.
Because he assumed that she had been so traumatized by the murder that she had forgotten what had happened. Deborah was familiar with Price because he had also helped her become a better parent. After meeting with Price, Deborah had a dream that her husband's friend, James Dean, had also been in the apartment too. James Dean was arrested the next day.
This is like that crazy child abuse scandal that happened in like the late 80s, where like these psychiatrists started saying that like, oh, they're being sexually abused by adults in their life, and it was all not true.
I haven't heard
and
that.
That's what it. That's what this is feeling like.
He was booked in the Gage County Jail. A guard wrote that he was, quote, pacing, crying, and talking to himself. He kept saying, I've been arrested on something I know nothing about, end quote. The sheriff's staff called Price to see if he could get James to calm down. In a long session with Price, 17 days after he'd been arrested, he broke down, saying he had been beaten as a child by his father and brother-in-law. Price told James that these childhood experiences had caused him to repress his memories of the crime. Although James had denied originally being involved, Price wrote that by the end of the session, James, quote, was doubting the veracity of his own statements, end quote. James then took a nap to see if he could get, quote, visions of things, end quote. He tried to let his mind wander into the case, and he soon gained clarity. James realized that Joseph, who he used to see at R&S Bar, which was a bar downtown that was kind of known as like a rougher kind of place,
okay,
reminded him of his brother-in-law who used to beat him. He said when he thought about the crime, what came to his mind was how his ex-brother-in-law had treated him, and he said he wouldn't be surprised if Joseph had pressured him into doing something immoral because his brother-in-law had also forced him to do things that made him uncomfortable. 6 days after James met with Price, he confessed to Cersei that he had been an accomplice to Helen's murder. He said that he had remembered it in his sleep. However, as I am sure you can guess, James' blood type was not type B either, so deputies urged him to try to recall if a sixth person had been in the room. James responded, quote, I got an idea, but I can't say, you know, I don't want to put a wrong name in there and get you guys in trouble. I'll put in the missing pieces as it comes back to me, end quote. 5 weeks after his arrest, James dreamed that a sixth person standing in Helen's apartment. At first, he wasn't sure if it was a man or a woman, but in another dream, he got a chance to rewind the scene, and he said based on the way the body was structured, he thought it was female. When he took a closer look, he recognized the person as Kathy Gonzalez. Now, Kathy Gonzalez had lived in the apartment just above Helen's. The next day, Kathy was arrested. Kathy had type B blood.
Thank God, because otherwise it might have been the
Beatrice
14, for God's sake.
Literally.
Could have been the whole damn town.
2 days after her arrest, she was visited by Price, who tried to jog her memory of the crime. Price had told Kathy she was a healthy, sane person, which confused her because then why couldn't she remember the crime? Price then told her that if he had witnessed the crime, he would block it out as well. But Kathy didn't really buy into his theory of memory because she had remembered the worst thing that had happened to her, that she had been molested by her uncle as a child. So she was like, if that was the worst thing to ever happen to me, why do I remember that? But I'm suppressing this.
So somebody using actual logic. Good for her.
But Price just kept insisting that she had repressed the memory and that if she just relaxed, the memory would come to her.
I want to punch this guy in the throat.
At the Gage County Jail, Kathy confronted Deborah and Joanne, asking them why they thought she participated in the crime. Deborah laughed and said, quote, I don't know, I just remember you. And Joanne said, quote, I don't actually remember you being there, end quote. The six people arrested would become known as the Beatrice Six.
God.
Deborah Shelton was the first of the six to plead guilty. James Dean followed, and a few months later, Joanne Taylor pleaded guilty as well. Tom Winslow gave a series of conflicting statements before he finally concluded he was not involved. He and Kathy Gonzalez both pleaded no contest, saying they had no memory of Wilson's murder. They were afraid that if they went to trial, they would get the death penalty. And that was definitely used as a threat.
Okay.
And to all these people. If you don't confess, if you don't plead, like if you don't plead guilty, we will go for the death penalty.
Which isn't overly shocking for the 80s. Actually, for even now, I feel like that happens.
Joseph White was the only one who tried to prove his innocence. He requested DNA testing, but his motion was denied. At his trial for rape and murder, the only evidence against him was his co-defendant's confessions. By this time, he had become the monster in all their lives. Because it was all his fault, essentially. He was the, you know.
Right.
He was found guilty after only 5 hours of deliberation and sentenced to life in prison. Joanne Taylor was sentenced to 40 years. Tom Lindzo was sentenced to 50 years. Kathy, Deborah, and James all received 10-year sentences.
This better not be the fucking end. I'm going to lose my goddamn mind.
It is not. Okay. Now, remember, we do have DNA in this case, both blood and semen. So, in 2008, both Joseph and Tom requested that the DNA be tested. When those DNA results came back, they did not match any of the Beatrice six, but they did, in fact, match a man named Bruce Allen Smith.
Wouldn't have been the craziest plot twist if it had matched Cersei. That would be crazy.
Bruce was actually interviewed early on in the investigation as well as part of the original 100, but was ruled out even though he did have type B blood. It was because the blood was ruled to be a type, oh gosh, I didn't write this down, so I might get it flip-flop, but a type B secretor, which I don't really know what that means, but Bruce's blood came back as a type B non-secretor.
Okay.
Or it might be flip-flopped. Either he was a secretor and that was a non-secretor. I'm not quite sure. So that's why he was originally
ruled out. Yeah, I've heard of that, but I don't know what it means.
On the night Helen was killed, Bruce had been drinking in a local bar before leaving for a party around midnight. After threatening to rape a fellow attendee at the party, he was thrown out. At approximately 3:30 a.m., someone drove Bruce back to Beatrice, and that is when it is believed that he entered Helen's apartment and committed the sexual assault and murder. He had been an early suspect because he was reported to be covered in blood the next day by a store clerk. There was also a wallet that he was suspected of stealing found near the crime scene. Bruce had left Nebraska for Oklahoma just days after the murder, and unfortunately, he died 7 years after Helen Wilson's death, so he was never brought to justice. The Beatrice Six was exonerated in 2009. The same year, Joseph White filed a civil rights lawsuit, and the group would ultimately be awarded $28.1 million from Gage County. They collectively had spent 77 years in jail for a crime they didn't commit and were essentially brainwashed into confessing to.
That's fucking crazy.
Joseph White, unfortunately, died in a work-related accident in 2011, so just 2 years after he got out of prison.
Ugh, that's so sad.
Tom Winslow currently lives a quiet life in Oklahoma. Joanne Taylor moved back to North Carolina, although she states that a lot of people still believe she is guilty, even though she has been exonerated. Deborah Sheldon had been last known to be living in Nebraska somewhere. And she was the last person, like, she still kind of believes she's guilty.
Really?
Like, she's the last person. Yes, she's the last person to have joined the lawsuit because she was so, like, well, she had that, you know, she was the easiest target, I feel like, in this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to finish and then I want to talk about some more stuff. Okay. But James Dean was reported to be working as a truck driver in Kansas, and Kathy Gonzalez had moved to New York, Nebraska, and worked as a grocery store clerk. Sorry. Now, a documentary on the story has come out in the past couple of years on HBO Max called Mind Over Murder, and I did binge watch it yesterday, and I kind of want to talk about it really fast. It is wild.
Yeah.
Highly, highly, highly worth the watch.
Okay.
They do talk to four of the six. They don't talk to Joanne, and obviously Joseph has passed.
Right.
So they talk to Kathy, Deborah, Tom, and James.
Okay.
So you kind of get to hear their side of things. They talk to Bert Searcy. Wow. And this man.
Do you want to punch him in the throat?
I have... I'm trying to choose my words very carefully when I talk about this because... Yes. These people are still alive.
Right.
That were in this document. This documentary came out maybe, I think it was 2022.
Okay.
So it's relatively new.
Right.
And Helen Wilson's poor family has kind of, this story has become less about Helen Wilson and more about the Beatrice Six. And right. That's very sad, unfortunately.
Yeah, for a murder victim to be forgotten in their own murder
exactly.
is pretty horrible.
But Bert Searcy... Oh my God, this man. He's quite old now, like very grandpa age.
And maybe you should have waited until he was dead to cover it.
At first I kind of felt bad for him.
Okay.
Because he like has been getting like he'll get death threats and like yikes, all this stuff.
PSA, everybody, that's never okay.
And people are going after him. And all this shit. But then I continued to watch the documentary and the man takes zero responsibility. He seriously? Still thinks they're guilty. Or at least that they were there. He's like brainwashed himself almost.
That is and honestly in turn, astonishing.
And in turn, in a way, I don't want to say brainwashed the family, but even the family is having a hard time coming to terms with the fact that the Beatrice Six isn't guilty. Or it wasn't at least involved in some way.
That's absolutely wild.
And he just, like, the whole, oh, God, it just pissed me off so much. And I could tell it was starting to piss off the poor woman who was doing the documentary, too. Because he just literally wouldn't. Because eventually they had a second investigation team come in.
Right.
And look at the case. After the like when the DNA they requested to get the DNA,
okay,
and the woman who did the second investigation was actually friends with Bert Searcy and like his wife and stuff.
Okay,
and
talk about awkward.
Yeah, they are not friends anymore. I can tell you that. But she was like, for example, remember that story I told you about how that 17-year-old informant who said that they were walking to school and at 7:30 watching.
The police
like she was
stuff,
like
yeah.
It was 7:30 because we were walking to school. Her body wasn't even found until 9:30 that morning. And it's just like, so it's not even the fact that they were all like brainwashed into confessing and believing that they were at a crime that they weren't actually at. But it's there was like a bunch of other things that just didn't match.
Like timeline just didn't make sense.
Yeah, and it didn't match the crime scene. Like one thing was. Oh, Kathy's blood got in the apartment because she fell back, hit her head on a mirror. The mirror broke and she cut herself. But there was never a broken mirror in the apartment. Okay. So it was like little things like that that just didn't make sense. And he just was like, I didn't make any mistakes. Of course, they're going to go back and look through this case. Well, I could go back through their case right now and point out all their mistakes too. And blah, 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 blah. And... It just, there's this very sad story that Tom Winslow talks about his time in prison. And unfortunately, he was sexually assaulted through his whole time in prison.
Oh, my God.
And he just, like, he refuses to, they show him, like, in Bert Searcy, this, like, an early cut of the documentary.
Yeah.
And he just, like, whenever one of the Beatrice Six comes on the screen, he goes on his phone. He doesn't listen. He's like, like he's making noises. And the poor documentary ladies are like, do you want me to stop this? And he's like, nope, keep going. You can keep going. I've just heard all this before. I just don't need to hear it anymore. I've just heard it all, like, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, and so he's just a terrible human being.
Yeah. And I'm like, if he would have just been like, you know, we made some mistakes. I obviously made mistakes. I have remorse for this. Yeah. I would have been like, okay, like, yeah, it was 1985. That doesn't excuse anything, right. But he didn't take any accountability.
That's pretty gross,
and
honestly.
It just, like, really pissed me off. And then, again, I felt so bad for this.
But again.
The family, because they're interviewing the family members in this. And I don't want to give too much away, but in the documentary, the actual town of Beatrice put on a play about the Beatrice Six, and they used the actual transcripts from the interviews as like the that was like the play essentially. Yeah. And their actors are portraying real life people because all these people are still alive.
Yeah.
And so her family members go to this play and finally see
like how fucked up it was.
Yeah. And you can just see because the poor guy who went just like it's like devastating to him because he's like for 30 years I thought this had been what happened, and then I see it laid out to me in this format, like this is the way I needed to see it laid out for it to realize that essentially these people were
like, give me chills.
Convicted off of dreams. Like imagine somebody dreamed you were involved in a crime and you were arrested and convicted off of that.
Yeah.
That's essentially what happened to all these people.
That gave me that. Oh my God. That literally gave me chills.
And there's one other thing I want to mention because there is a lawyer in this $8.1 million settlement who told Tom Winslow, and they all say this is like the one moment that like changed because the first trial ended in a mistrial. This is like the moment they say changed everything. A lawyer for it must have been the county. I don't know, whoever they sued, looked at Tom Winslow and was like, well, you went to jail for a sex-related crime. What were you expecting, not to be raped? Yeah.
It makes me
sick.
Sick to think that people think like that. People that are supposed to be intelligent people.
Yeah.
You're a lawyer, for God's sake. You're supposed to be smarter than that. How fucking dare you?
Yeah.
How dare...
And this was after we knew that they did nothing wrong.
And he's probably one of those people that's like, well, what was she wearing?
She.
Oh! She was probably... Okay. She was... Excuse me. I apologize for assuming gender. But yeah. She's probably one of those lawyers that's like, well, what was she wearing?
Yeah.
It doesn't fucking matter.
So...
Ooh, you really just... you lit me up. I'm fucking fired up now.
They do say this is... A lot of people call this one of the biggest misjustices in American history. And
how have we not
exactly how have heard, we not of, heard this? Of this? I know, I was mind blown. And how have we not found it earlier?
Right.
And
like, we've been doing this for like 4 years
literally,
now.
Literally, which was shocking to me. And I mean, this is a huge story. I could have gotten a lot more in depth on a lot more things, but I highly, highly, highly recommend everyone watch that documentary if they are interested in this case.
And it's kind of gonna be in the sources, right?
Since yeah, it's in the sources. Okay, it's on HBO Max, so I watched it through Prime. I think it's like 6 episodes and they're like an hour each, so I mean it did take some time to watch, but oh my God, I was raging yesterday, let me tell you. I just could not believe some of the stuff that was said.
Like, are you okay?
Yeah. She like left and went and did stuff and she came back and I was still sitting here. I was like, I'm fucking pissed off. But yeah, I think it's a good story and it's a crazy story. I do know that Wayne Price, they didn't talk to him, but from what other people said in the documentary, it seemed like maybe he had a little bit of remorse.
Okay.
Which is good.
A little late, but... At least somebody has some compassion.
Yeah. Fuck, there was one more thing I wanted to say. Oh, you know how Bruce Smith was originally ruled out because he was he was type B, but he was, like, not the right...
Yeah, secretor, non-secretor, whatever.
Turns out the woman who did the original blood testing was found out to be like a fraud, and she did this in like many, many cases where she did the wrong shit, and it was found.
My God.
12 people actually were killed
on death row.
Yep.
Oh my God. Because this is why I have such a hard time with death row.
Yeah, when that fucking came out, well, literally when they said that on the documentary, that was my exact reaction. It was like 12 people innocent.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah. And she didn't have remorse either. She was like, well, sometimes we make mistakes. Huh?
Were they put to death, or were they just on death row?
No, they were put to death.
Oh my God. You, sorry. Ma'am, you are essentially responsible for the murders of 12 people. You're essentially a serial killer, you fucking bitch.
Yeah, I couldn't remember if they could, like,
that makes me want to vomit.
I don't remember how that resolute. I mean, that could probably be its own story, honestly. So maybe I'll keep it quiet. But
oh my God.
Okay, that's the last thing I want to say about this, because I could talk about it forever.
Yeah,
I would love for you to watch the documentary, and then
as soon as I'm done with school, I will have more time to.
We can chat about it, but
so give me like four more weeks.
And yeah,
I'll be able to have some free time again.
So if anyone else watches it, please reach out.
Message Emily.
I would love to go down a deep dark hole with you. I didn't even touch Reddit. I'm sure I could go on there and like spend hours. So,
yeah. Yikes.
Yeah. Okay. That's all I had.
Okay. That was great.
Sources.
Yeah. Sources
are The New Yorker, Oxygen, Vanity Fair, Bustle. I had two different, articles from Bustle.
Okay.
Grunge, and then Mind Over Murder on HBO Max is a documentary.
And our socials are MW Madness Podcast @gmail.com. That is also our Instagram, and we are Midwest Madness Podcast on Facebook.
All right, guys. Have a great rest of your week. We will talk to you next Tuesday, and I will be 30. Okay, bye.
Bye.